respond to changes of pressure and of temperature. And now we come to applications to other science, to geology, to astronomy, to ultra-fast chemistry, across the whole spectrum of the sciences. In no way is the facility that we inaugurate here in any sense limited to the field of nuclear science. It is part now of all of science and all of technology, and will make contributions to all of them. And I mention technology here because this is a very rapidly growing area and one that I want to come back to at the end of my time. Now, to give some idea, the roadmap perhaps, of where we are and where this new facility fits, I have adapted a slide prepared originally by David Scott of this laboratory. And the dashed areas here simply indicate regions where new kinds of physics might be expected. This is where these curves drawn on here are the boundaries of the areas that can be reached by different accelerators. This is the boundary that can be reached by a large tandem, a large cyclotron of the kind we've used in many places in this country and abroad. This is where MSU functions. All this, the Bevelak and the synchrophasotron and Dubna have touched this area, and we've had some marvelous speculation today up in this area. And I was reminded overwhelmingly this morning as we heard this speculation, and in fact about this whole area still, of the marvelous opening sentence that one of my graduate students, who was a Harvard undergraduate, who was going to get a Yale PhD and was going to be a great physicist, but the opening sentence in the first draft of his thesis read as follows: "This field of research is so virginal that no human eyeball has ever set foot in it." There are somewhere between 10 and 100,000 levels of spin 36, 38, and 40, and yet we only see half a dozen. What are these half dozen? Well, Russell Betts has made a fairly convincing argument, it seems to me, that these are the special states where the 56 neutrons and protons in nickel 56, if given these precise energies, spontaneously divide themselves into two groups of 28, each of which looks like silicon 28, and the two move in a rather stately minuet with respect to one another. And this is totally unexpected. We are now at 10 times the energy required for this nucleus to disintegrate. And yet, we find this marvelously simple behavior. And if this is true, and I believe it is just an indication of a tremendous additional amount of study that must be done in this area. And this emphasizes a point I have made many times before, and that is that every time we look with adequate resolution to resolve sharp structure in the nucleus or long-lived states, we find them. And this facility that we have dedicated here today is a facility that will allow studies of this to move up certainly into the unknown. We don't know what's going to happen up here, but something very exciting may happen right about there, and I'll go back to it in a few moments. Now, a lot of the time in nuclear science is taken up and has been taken up over the years with measuring the quantum states of the nuclear system. It's so-called nuclear spectroscopy, and in some circles it has become a dirty word. There's a feeling that nuclear spectroscopy has been dying under its own weight. And to the extent that it is an exquisite form of stamp collecting, it should. But at the same time, there is a renaissance in this field. And it comes from work of my colleague Yukello from Arima in Tokyo, Ptolemy in Israel, and it provides a new way of looking at, a new way of correlating what we know about the structure of nuclei. And central to this idea is the use of algebra rather than geometry, and the postulation of basic structural entities, and the use of group theory, marvelous branch of mathematics, which tells us how to put together those entities to build the nuclei that we study. This is a technique that has worked marvelously well in particle physics, where it is used to order the quarks. Let me show you on the next slide three examples of three special cases. These are the three limiting symmetries of the nucleus. The rotor, where the nucleus behaves like a rigid rotor, on this side in each case, I show the theoretical calculations. On this side, I show the experimental measurements made in large measure by heavy ion-induced reactions, Coulomb excitation, and heavy ion XN gamma. And you notice here the rotor, here the harmonic vibrator, here a triaxial rotor, and you will notice that the agreement is really superb. Beyond this, and for the first time, it becomes possible to calculate what happens between these limits in a very simple way that experimentalists themselves can carry out. And because we are dealing with symmetries and changes in symmetries, this approach makes it possible for us to rather quickly and accurately understand transitions between different states in nuclei. These are the so-called dynamic symmetries in nuclei. What they do is to group states in a given nucleus into multiplets or families which share a common structure, common parentage. One of the goals in many parts of physics for many years, in gravitational physics, to rather quickly and accurately understand transitions between different states in nuclei. These are the so-called dynamic symmetries in nuclei. What they do is to group states in a given nucleus into multiplets or families which share a common structure, common parentage. One of the goals in many parts of physics for many years, in gravitational physics, in particle physics, has been the search for a supersymmetry. This is a more sophisticated beast, and in the nuclear case, it would group not only the levels in a single nucleus, it would group many nuclei and all their levels into one large family with common parentage and structure. That supersymmetry within this past year has been discovered, we believe, in the osmium-iridium region. Now, there's much to be done. The symmetries are not perfect, they are broken, but this provides a new way of coordinating nuclear data, nuclear information, and suggests new measurements, it suggests new insight, and it also suggests that nuclei are much simpler than we had thought previously they might be. So I think this is a real progress. And what it does is to allow us to pose new questions and pose them sharply. And we have, in the kind of facility here at MSU, the possibility of answering those sharply posed questions unambiguously and in the not-too-distant future. This is the situation with bound quantum states, with the structure of nuclei. What happens for the scattering states? The next slide simply shows you that the same situation works there. These are scattering resonances in heavy ions, They were the first of these discovered where carbon interacts with carbon. This is interesting in the nuclear case. It is also interesting because it conditions the twilight phase of dying stars. And can we understand these? When years ago in Chalk River we measured the first three of these, it was clear that life was simple. There were many theories that explained everything. When we found finally 39 of these, it became clear that there wasn't any hope whatever of understanding them. And again, fortunately, with the new search for dynamic symmetries, we have come up, Yukello has come up with this marvelously simple little relation, and here are all 39 of the resonances organized into nice, neat families, which give us considerable insight into what's going on. There are lots of questions. Where are the remaining bosons? How does this algebraic picture agree with the old geometric picture? And so on. But this is the challenge, and this is the challenge that I think we're prepared to meet. Now, I mentioned high angular momentum, high spin. Let me have the next slide. Here are some rather beautiful angular distributions obtained by Stephanie DiCenzo, Russell Betts, Peterson, a few other people working at Yale and at Brookhaven. This is the highest angular momentum that has ever been uniquely defined, to the best of my knowledge. It is a spin of 42 units in nickel 56. And the interesting thing is that even a simple model tells us that at about 50, nickel 56 spontaneously flies apart. And so we ran out of energy, and the existing facilities in this country, the ones suitable for this work, at this point. Michigan State now will give us access to take this up to find out what happens to a nucleus when you spin it so fast that it really begins to rip itself apart under centrifugal stresses. And this whole question of how a nucleus responds to increasing spin is a fascinating one. Does it just spin faster as a rigid body? Do the individual neutrons and protons uncouple so that each one can contribute more effectively to the total spin? We know some of the answers. We've heard some talks on this already at this conference. There will be more. This is a tremendous challenge posed to our knowledge of how nuclei are put together. And a good example, incidentally, of current state of the art in this field is this next slide that John Schiffer provided from work done at the new LINAC system at the Argonne National Laboratory. This is dysprosium-152, and you can see that it is up now to a spin of 38 units. And not only that, but the lifetime of these states has been measured using the microstructure of the beam of that accelerator. This state lives 1.2 million millionths of a second. Now, the MSU machine shares this marvelous quality of a precise microstructure and will permit this kind of measurement. Now, let me leave what might be called classical nuclear physics at this point and take a moment to talk about a neighboring science, atomic physics. Anyone who has a nodding acquaintance with an atom knows that an atom is mostly empty space, and the nucleus is a tiny little beast lurking in the middle of it. That being the case, it was pointed out a long time ago by Piper and Greiner that if you put two nuclei very close together, the electrons, let's just skip that and go on to the next one, the electrons would not be able to tell the difference whether you had one nucleus present or whether you had two. And this gives you the possibility of putting together and studying on a temporary basis, twice the number of chemical atoms, chemical species, that Mother Nature provides. This technique has been shown to work in a number of laboratories, including ours at Yale, where Jack Greenberg has been working on this. But most interesting is the fact that as you make these nuclei heavy, when they get up close to lead, you get what is called a supercritical electrostatic field, and the inner electrons are bound by more than twice the rest mass of the electron. This means the inner electrons in this superatom are pulled down into the infinite antimatter C that the Dirac equation predicts. Now, or describes, if in the early stages of the collision you produce a vacancy in this inner state of the atom, it can be carried down into the antimatter C, where it can be filled by one of the negative energy electrons, and out will come an unaccompanied positron. The vacuum will have ionized itself. This is a pure quantum electrodynamic effect. Now, there are other processes, of course, that can also give you positrons. The other processes, it can be shown, depend on the total number of protons present to the 20th power. This process, the quantum electrodynamic process of greatest interest, depends on the total number of protons present to the 70th power. This is a remarkable behavior. And what we need here are heavier ions, clearly heavier ions, heavier species. But let's see what Greenberg and his collaborators from GSI and from Frankfurt have found within this last month or so. They have indeed found the positrons that are predicted corresponding to the negative energy electrons in the antimatter C filling holes. This is the kind of shape you would expect. But sitting on top of this shape is this peak, which is totally unexpected. It has about 70 kilovolts width, but that's all probably mostly Doppler shift, and it may be as narrow as 10 kilovolts. And no one really knows at this point what it is, except that it is new and exciting physics. And perhaps the best guess at the moment as to what it is that the uranium don't just come in and brush off one another and scatter. They actually stick together and form a molecule which lives for a certain period, during which period a single energy positron is emitted. And calculations have been done recently which show that the uranium, which it looks this way, that's the shape of a uranium nucleus, that this kind of collision, nose to nose, does in fact show signs of giving just this kind of behavior. And if this is true, then we have seen the positrons that quantum electrodynamics predicts, and here it's first order, not a very high order correction. And we also have seen possibly a temporary existence of an element of atomic number 184. That's a real heavy nucleus. And this is a challenging field that this particular accelerator will allow us in this country now to really take up and push forward. Now, obviously one of the main advantages of this new machine that Hank Blosser and his associates have completed is that it goes to higher energies than we have had accessible to us before. And what does this mean? And I go back to another schematic diagram of Dave Scott's on the next slide, which simply lists all the various things that can happen. And down here at low energy, the nuclei are rather casual about it all, and the collision time is long compared to the characteristic motion of particles inside the nucleus, so the whole nucleus responds coherently to the collision. Up here at high energy, however, the collision time is short compared to the characteristic time of internal motion, and it may well be that much of the nucleus doesn't know that the collision is taking place until it's all over. And it may well be that we're going to get little sections of the nuclei that will be hot, active, and the rest will essentially behave as spectators. So the question is, can we measure how big the active area is? Well, there's several ways of doing this. We have recourse to thermodynamics, and we can talk to our astronomer friends who long ago invented marvelous techniques for measuring how big Sirius, the dog star, was, for example, by interferometry. We can use that too. And the next figure, and you may quibble about all sorts of detail here, but if you put all these various techniques together, the general result is that the active region in the nucleus is somewhere between 3 and 4 units in dimension, and this is much smaller than the nucleus, the whole nuclear system. So, indeed, we do have some hot spots. Now, the question of temperature is an equilibrium concept. What its validity is applied here in a non-equilibrium situation is, of course, open to question. But I'm going to come back to it, and we'll use it anyway. One of the real problems that has faced us for some time is, how do we understand the details of this kind of a collision? And we've heard this morning, as part of the symposium, some excellent papers on this work. And I want to take, on the next figure, some calculations of Stocker, Maroon, Greiner, to show what happens if you smack a uranium nucleus with a neon nucleus at about 400 MeV per nucleon. And there are two kinds of calculations here. Here we believe that the nucleus is made up of a fluid, an Euler fluid. Here we use what's called in the trade the impulse approximation, and we assume on a more microscopic level that the individual neutrons and protons collide with one another seriatim. And we follow it through. Now what happens? Here is for a central collision, head on. Here is for a collision which is not head on. Head on, you see, we have a very hot region. We have a lot of matter being shoved out in a shock wave. Here, there is not as dominant a shock wave. Down here, nothing gets as hot. But you get this marvelous bounce-off effect, where the projectile hits the target, gives most of it some velocity at 90 degrees, bounces off. Well, what do we have to compare this with? Well, fortunately, we have some new data of Stock et al. From Berkeley. And we heard about this morning, too. Here are the data for protons of these various energies. And here are the calculations, two different kinds of cascade models, various kinds of fireball models, fluid dynamic models, and here a fluid dynamic model that recognizes that the system is very hot and that it will evaporate. And if you look at this, you see that this does seem to have something of the general character of this. This doesn't, nor does this, or this. And this tells us that maybe we can do something with hydrodynamics and gives us some confidence in using this approach. But now what about this question of temperature? There are very few data at the moment. But if I plot temperature here, and just to give you a feeling for scale, 100 MeV temperature corresponds to 1,000,000 degrees Kelvin. These are hot nuclei. Here are the points. Can we understand them? The simplest picture you could make is to say, okay, particles involved, neutrons and protons, are simply inert bodies, and we'll contain them in a certain volume. And that makes a Fermi gas model. And you see it doesn't work. But that's not surprising. You wouldn't expect it to work. Because this suggests, we know, that as you put energy into a system like this, the neutrons and protons can get excited. You can make the heavier hadrons. Now, this is a very important question. Temperatures of 1,000,000 degrees are pretty rare around here, thank God. But they are what characterizes the early instants of our universe. They are also what characterizes the ultimate stages of that great catastrophe when a star undergoes gravitational collapse. What happens in either of those situations, at the birth, the death of our universe, is determined by what this curve does here. Does this level off and saturate as there might be a hint, or does it not? We don't know yet. And these are measurements that must and can be done in the near future. Will the mass spectrum of the hadrons saturate? And this is a tremendously important and interesting question. Now let me move on to the question that I mentioned at the beginning of the possibility of totally new kinds of matter. Whenever we talk about matter normally, most of you have had some experience, those of you who are scientists of whatever persuasion, have had some experience looking at a so-called PV diagram, a pressure volume diagram, where you look for phase changes, or you look for anomalies, singularities. In the nuclear case, it's not convenient to use pressure and volume directly. Rather, one uses energy density per nucleon, and the derivative of that is the pressure, and the density, which is proportional to 1 over the volume. And you get this kind of a curve. Normal nuclear matter sits right there. Now, we don't know whether this curve looks like A or B or C. And in 1974, T.D. Lee, Giancarlo Wick, made a rather compelling argument that there was nothing we had at that time available to us in the way of information that could tell us which of those curves was correct. And that if we increased the density of nuclear matter, we might go into this kind of a picture or into this kind of a picture. This would give us so-called density isomers. This would give us a totally new kind of matter, a strange kind of matter in which much diminished neutrons and protons floated in a thick pionic soup with a voracious appetite for neutrons. It would make a marvelous way to store energy with one small problem. We have not the slightest idea how to get the energy out. Now the question is, can we find out which of those is really the case? Well, it turns out that indeed one can. The calculations that I showed earlier, the hydrodynamic calculations, can calculate the number of pions that should be emitted as a function of energy. And for A, B, or C, one should get these curves. A, B, or C. What do the data show? Here are the data. These different curves are calculated for different assumed viscosity. Well, before we get too discouraged, this looks very much like normal nuclear matter. But before we get too discouraged, Michigan State operates right down here. And we know that at 80 MeV, compression starts, density starts to increase, and the 200 MeV, we can already get three times normal nuclear density. So it may well be that down here at the toe of this curve, which is reachable here at Michigan State, will be one of the most exciting and interesting areas yet to be studied. Whatever happens here, we know that something strange is going on. Here are the so-called anomalons. And this is one of the early measurements from the Bevelad. 1.88 GeV per nucleon iron is fired into a nuclear emulsion. Friedlander, Heckman, and their associates have carried out detailed studies that have now been confirmed by groups around the world. And what they find is that in about 6% of the cases, something happens, something we don't understand. The mean free path of the nucleus all at once drops by a factor of 10. In other words, the nucleus acts as though it were 10 times bigger than normal. There have been all sorts of marvelous explanations for this. That there's an extra quark attached and the color field increases the range of the force. That we've got hollow nuclei. All sorts of explanations. No one at the moment knows the answer. But clearly, this is something that is real. This iron nucleus interacts again.